Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Some of the most important decisions that we make in our lives involve the end of our lives. They are legacy decisions that should be made well before we reach the end of life stage. Advanced preparation can make those final days a lot more comfortable for those approaching life's end, with assurances that their end-of-life wishes will be carried out. It's easier on family and other loved ones as well. We're going to be talking about all of that today, so get a pencil and take notes, or pick up a copy of the book, The Sandbox Wars, End-of-Life Decisions, The Most Important Gift to Your Family. The author is Stephanie Payne. She's a St. Louisan and a registered nurse who has seen more than her share of the kind of heartbreak and familial chaos when final wishes are uncertain or unclear. She joins me in studio along with estate planning attorney Melissa Riddle, who wrote the foreword to Stephanie Payne's book. Ladies, I welcome you both. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Don. Good
Thanks
to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Stephanie, let me begin with you. You say the most important message of your book is to take action now. What do you mean?
Well, if we don't take action, then a lot of times the decisions that we want for the end of our life will not be heeded by our family. And that's why I wrote the book, The Sandbox Wars. My parents had most of their documents ready, but they were missing one. And when my elderly mother got terminally ill, my siblings came in and took her to court and tried to destroy the trust. And it wasn't until I saw the whole story from the beginning to end that I realized how many families were being tortured with all these litigations and conflicts.
Yeah, this is not an unusual story in terms of the families coming to that kind of a situation at odds with each other at the end of one's life.
It is so common. You know, I started calling some of the probate departments around the counties here, and there's over 7,500 probates active in the St. Louis County right now, and probably over 15,000 in the metro St. Louis area. So this is extremely common.
You know, I think we're going to have to do some definitions along the way, because as you indicate in the book, not many people think about this until very late in the game, and probably don't know what a lot of these things actually mean. So Melissa, I'll turn to you. What is probate?
Probate is where you generally have a will, or you pass away without a will, and your estate is then subject to the court system in whatever jurisdiction you live in. And the probate court basically opens what we call a probate estate. It has to stay open for a minimum of 6 months. Nowadays, I see them staying open much longer, especially if real estate is involved. But the probate estate is what your estate consists of when you pass away, that is then subject to the court system to hammer out who is going to be the beneficiary of those assets.
You know, I think most people probably think that all you really need is a will.
That's true. And certainly a will is better than having nothing. But when you have just a basic will, then you are going to be subject to probate. That is going to have to be filed with the court, and the court is going to have the ultimate say-so in that matter. In addition to having your creditors make claims, it's a public record. Anyone can go on CaseNet and pull it up and see the value of the estate, who's going to receive that. So for most of my clients, what they like to pair that will is what we call a living trust, which is a trust that they put in place during their lifetime, which remains a private document. It keeps those assets out of the probate. It keeps them private. It keeps down the expense related to probate, and just the fact that you have a court system that's making decisions instead of yourself. Mm.
Stephanie, your book is titled The Sandbox Wars, and we've already indicated that this is kind of what happens in so many cases. The book is filled with various stories. We can't tell them all, but give me a story or two that really reflects the kind of situation that can arise.
Well, one of my favorite stories, I think it's called Keeping Time, is when at the end of life, there was the story is about a man who basically died in his home and was revived and put on life support. And they had a living will and an advance directive, and the wife in the story was the power of attorney for that and to make all those decisions. But the wife didn't know how to make that decision. And the daughter had to coach and explain what the living will meant and what this client wanted. He didn't want any ventilators or feeding tubes. And it took a long time to explain to this elderly woman why they needed to follow the documents. And so many times as a hospice nurse, I've had people fill out their advance directives, living wills, and power of attorneys as the nurses are walking in the door. I just recently heard a story of a lady who passed away after being on hospice, and they hadn't even picked out a funeral home yet. And those decisions just need to be made a lot earlier in life when we're sound mind, when we're more comfortable, when we know our decisions making. It needs to be just more clear.
Well, when? When would that be? When you're 30, 40, 50? When?
Well, you know, I did a documentary. It's called Legacy Decisions, about that. And I've learned so much just from listening to the content of the DVD that we did. And we need to start making our decisions when we buy a car, buy a house, anything that has a title or a deed on it, is part of our estate. And at that point, as soon as you have children, that's the time to start getting your estate plan done. Because if you don't, sudden death can really, you know, put a roller coaster on families. And I've seen that happen with someone dying, from massive heart attack, and there's no estate plan done, and they're only not even 50. And one of the things I've noticed is that we're not having the conversation about death and dying early enough. And it's such, we're all going to have to deal with it at some point in our life. It's inevitable. I've been nursing for 30 years and tens of thousands of patients, and, we all die. And we're not dealing with it like, what did you have for lunch today?
When you talk about having a conversation, who should be having the conversation?
I started the conversation with my children when they were very young, with my with the pets that we had. You know, when your dog dies at 5 or 6 or 10 years old, that's a good time to start the education about, well, mom and dad are going to die, or our grandmother's sick. That it's just part of a conversation that we need to have. And denying that that we're going to die is pretty silly. It doesn't serve us well to not talk about it.
Melissa, when does the lawyer get involved?
Well, you were asking, first of all, when you were talking about when to start the estate plan, I know I've told Stephanie this story before, but when I was in law school, my trust and estates professor said everyone in this room should at least have a basic will. And at that point, I was 21 years old. I had nothing but an apartment full of Goodwill furniture, and I thought he was just completely crazy, because why would I need a will? But I think it's important for everyone to have some basic documents in place. And really, the lawyer should be someone that helps you through the process. Most of my clients come to me not really knowing what an estate plan is, what they might need. And that first initial meeting is really just educating them, as saying, okay, this is how a will works. This is how a trust works. These are medical directives, powers of attorney, and letting them understand what the documents would be so that they can then go home and discuss with their spouse or their loved ones what they might want in that regard. So I think it's a process that starts very early on with the lawyer, and then continues on through all of the discussions for the important decisions that have to be made.
Stephanie, a couple of problems I see there, not the least of which is people when they're 21 or 31 or 41 are not thinking about death. And they're also thinking about, if I go to a lawyer and get the ball rolling on all of this, it's going to be expensive.
You know, I was really surprised when, after my mom passed away, and I had not had my trust done yet, but I made a promise to my children that I was going to get it done, because I didn't want my children to have to go through what I went through with my siblings, fighting in court for 2.5 years. And when the attorney that I went to, he laid out how much the trust would cost versus how much a probate on my estate would be, and it was like 10 times more. So it was like a bargain if you look at it, and the administrative costs after I would pass on a trust is significantly less than it would be, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to go through probate, compared to just literally $2,000 or $3,000 for a trust. Now, I've learned learning so much with David and Melissa, that it's good to go back to the attorney once in a while and make sure that everything's fine, nothing's changed, there's no disabled children, or someone else has passed away, or we have a sister or brother or sibling that's not behaving very well, and you might want to do something else with your trust. But I've learned that, and all that's really easy to do, and it's not that expensive, I've learned.
Does it bother you, Melissa, that I bring up the cost issue? Because I know that's on many people's minds.
Not at all. Not at all, because I think that is a huge consideration for a majority of my clients. They think of an estate plan as something that's going to be very expensive. What they'll find with me, and I think what they'll find with a lot of my colleagues, is that most attorneys are going to do this on a flat fee basis. So before they have any commitment, they can go in and they can find out what it would cost. And they can compare that, as Stephanie was saying, to the cost of a probate. And so they can make an educated decision. It's not something where a majority of attorneys are not going to take this on an hourly fee where that clock's ticking every time they ask a question. They're going to know going in approximately what this type of plan is going to cost them, and then they can make the decision as to whether it makes sense to them financially. But of course, I never hesitate to back away from fees, because if I were, you know, the roles were reversed, that's absolutely the question I would be asking.
Well, why is probate so expensive?
It is expensive because you have court involvement. It's expensive because by statute in Missouri, the attorney who administers the estate is going to get a set percentage of that state. It's a graduated scale. So I can't tell you exactly the percentage, but if you look at the value of the estate, the attorney is going to get a cut. The personal representative who administers is going to get a cut. There's always going to be unexpected things come up. You have creditors that can much more easily make claims, which have to be paid out. And so when you look at the overall picture, even on a modest estate, you're well over what a flat fee would be to put the documents together to avoid that.
Okay. One other thing before we take a break, pardon me, is to define trust, because we've used the word a number of times. Not sure everybody knows what we're talking about.
A trust is a private agreement. It's contractual in nature between the person making it and the person that they want to act as their successor, who would then take over and handle things for them.
Is that the executor?
It is the same as an executor. We call them a successor trustee. And if they were over a probate estate, it'd be an executor. But it's basically the person that you name in your place to take over if you're not able to due to incapacity or death.
All right. Well, we have to take that break now. Let's do that. We'll continue our conversation about planning for death. It's not the most cheerful subject that we could come up with for the day, but it certainly is an important one, as we're learning. My guests in studio are Stephanie Payne. She is the author of The Sandbox Wars, End of Life Decisions, The Most Important Gift to Your Family, and that's what we're talking about today. Also with me in studio is Melissa Riddle. She wrote the foreword of that book, and she is an estate planning attorney. We have many questions already from listeners. We'll come back and start taking those in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about legacy decisions, end-of-life decisions, those things that we have to do before our final day or days, and to make life easier for those who survive us. My guest in studio, Stephanie Payne, author of The Sandbox Wars, End-of-Life Decisions, The Most Important Gift to Your Family. Estate planning attorney Melissa Riddle is also with us. As part of your subtitle, Stephanie, you have the word gift to the words, gift to the family. What exactly do you mean by that?
I learned about this process as I was writing the book and talking with estate planning attorneys and certified financial planners, and I didn't really realize the power of what that meant. It's like an education for our families about creating, if we have a legacy, big or small, doesn't matter, that we're going to pass on not only some jewelry or maybe some monies and things like that, but we're going to pass on our legacy. And I've learned that so many families have just been destroyed because of over the silverware or the rings or the jewelry. And that's not what my no, but that's not what my parents wanted. They did not want that, absolutely. And I've talked to certainly hundreds of families, and I hear these stories. And looking at end of life as a gift, as a part of like financial education, you know, that everybody's going to die, let's do it the right way. You know, in the 10,000 patients that I've taken care of, I can literally count on my fingers and toes how many had all of their documents done. And when that was in place, it was the most amazing event. I saw so much love and generosity. And there's one of the stories is about that, where there's family and friends and music and reminiscing. And it just is the most amazing gift to your family.
One of the things you say in your book, I see in my notes here, is the issue is less often money than it is things of sentimental value, that this is what really can get people worked up. Go ahead and you respond to that. Melissa, you're nodding your head. Obviously, you've run across this sort of thing.
I just see so much of this, Don. It's just amazing how people will want that piece of artwork, that piece of jewelry. It's just silly, almost, the things that people want. And I understand. I love sentiment. I have little collections of things. But to be able to not argue over that and break up a family, people don't understand the gravity of having to, you know, my sister was angry at me because I got a ring. Mm-hmm. You know, how silly to break up a whole relationship over a piece of jewelry.
So part of the conversations that you mentioned earlier that we should be having is saying, I want Joe to get the ring and I want John to get the watch and I want so-and-so to get the piece of artwork.
And write it down.
Attach
it to the documents that your attorney makes. And it's not a complicated document. And you can change that. You can change the list of, you know, things on the list as time changes.
Melissa?
It is. It is a very easy thing to do. And it's something that I really encourage my clients to do. When we do a full estate plan and we set forth the trust, part of that is a reference to that the grantors, the persons making the trust, can outline who they would like to have certain personal belongings. And I always encourage clients to do that because those are the things. About half my practice is trust and estate litigation, and about half is estate planning. And the things that tend to spark the litigation and keep the litigation going are often the personal property because of the sentimental value. We can divide up the liquid assets very easily, but there's only one wedding ring.
Sure.
And so to the degree that people can set forth those wishes ahead of time, it really takes that burden off of their children. And that is where I see a significant amount of litigation is in the personal property, which, quite frankly, when you get into litigation from a business standpoint, doesn't make any sense to litigate because you're spending much more money than what the property's worth trying to litigate.
The personal property, talking about the personal things that we've been talking about. You had mentioned earlier on that actual property, real estate, is a major complication, particularly during probate. Why is that?
With the real estate market the way it is now, whoever is going to be in charge of selling that, the personal representative if it's a probate.
The house we're talking about.
Yeah. They're going to have a fiduciary obligation to get the very best value they can. And in this market, that sometimes isn't something that can be done very quickly. Sometimes the house is most of the estate. There's very little liquid assets available. And then they're running into a problem of, well, it needs certain repairs made. It needs certain things done to get it on the market. But there's no one to put forth that money. So real estate can really draw out a probate because it can be very time consuming. Whereas if it's in a trust, it can be managed in different ways.
And as you pointed out, time is money in this context.
Absolutely.
Let's go to the phones. There's so much to talk about, but listeners have questions that we want to put before you ladies. We'll start with the first caller, Jerry and O'Fallon. Go ahead. Nice to talk to you again.
Good morning. I just want to we lost my father about 3 years ago and my mother actually earlier this week.
Oh, condolences.
Well, thank you. And my parents had the foresight not only to have a very have a trust set up that you know, pretty detailed trust, but also, and I used to work for a funeral home company as well, they had prearranged their services, and I can't tell you how much easier that makes it on the surviving family. I can also tell you from not this firsthand experience, but from observing that while that sounds relatively innocuous to try to plan a service, I've seen everything up to and including fistfights for family members getting together to try to determine, you know, how much to spend and what kind of service they feel that their parents wanted and things like that. So the more things I think that are made specific, and as you're saying, most disputes, it seems like, in estates come not from the big things, but, yeah, who's going to get the ring? Who's going to get the silverware? Who's going to get that picture that they always coveted? So for the listeners out there in a position to do something to plan for what's going to happen to all of us, I highly, highly recommend it if you care at all about your surviving family members. Thank you.
Jerry, thanks for the call. I think you're not going to get any disagreement from folks in the studio.
One of the things that's so important about what you said is that making decisions right after mom or dad dies just adds 10 times more stress to the situation anyway, and that's not a good time to be making decisions. It's better to make them years before and have it written down. And it just it makes it so it can be easier and more pleasant.
And the pre-planned funeral, the pre-planned burial site, all of that is important.
All the way down to the clothes. Everything can be checked out. You know, and there's people have their life insurance, you know, designated for payment. They can go pick out, you know, flowers, caskets, everything, so that when the event does happen, they just go in and say it's time. And so the party's already planned, and I like it that way. It can be a time of celebration for that family rather than a time of start the fight.
I wonder if there's any kind of a percentage out there, a working percentage of the number of people who do plan ahead for this sort of thing. Any idea?
I think that the general statistics, I mean, obviously, depending on where you're getting from, they can differ, but it's somewhere in the nature of 70% of Americans, 70 do not have a complete estate plan.
That's why this program is important for people to at least begin thinking about that. They may not run to a lawyer or start talking, having those conversations today, but they better be thinking about them soon.
And it's not really about the money. I had a client recently that told me, she read the book and talked about it, and she had not a large estate. She was helping her mom get prepared, and she went to legal services. They did a few documents so that there won't be a fight. So it is not about economics. It's about getting it done to prevent the hassles.
I want to run over some of the documents, the list of documents you have in your book, but let's get a couple more calls in, and some of these issues will come up, I'm sure, with the callers. Michael is next. He's calling from St. Louis. Thanks for waiting, Michael. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Donnie. Well, my feeling is that Missouri probate law is really corrupt. I know my parents died, and they had a notarized will, and it was uncontested with my brother and sister and I. And you know, we learned that we had to go to probate court anyway, even though we had a fine will. And so I bought one of those do-it-yourself probate books, and I downloaded the relevant forms from the St. Louis County website and filled them out. And it wasn't any harder than filling out income tax return. Then I drove to Clayton and submitted it to the probate court. And the clerk asked, "Are you an attorney?" And I said, "No." And the clerk said, "Well, according to Missouri law, we can only accept it from an attorney." And so you get an attorney, and then I find out that the attorney gets a percentage of the house, a percentage of the car, a percentage of all the mutual funds. It just really seems unfair for a simple probate, uncontested probate. I'm hoping, Don, that maybe KWMU can be a vehicle for changing this law, like some website or something where people can get together. I called Representative Tim Jones, and well, he's an attorney anyway, and he said, "Oh, it's just too complicated." So I
absolutely.
So that's my comment.
I hope that Michael, thank you so much for the call. Melissa, I think that this has to go to you.
Sure, absolutely. I can ultimately sympathize with the situation because it is very frustrating to people. And this is something that people do not understand when they are putting together documents or is the complexity of the legal system that we have. It's dictated by statute in Missouri across the state. A basic will has to go to probate. It has to have the court involvement. It has to be very specific. It has to be executed in an extremely specific way that doesn't necessarily always mesh with people thinking the way that they should be able to handwrite something out. Under Missouri law, you can't. You cannot handwrite out a will without certain legal ramifications to that. And really, you would have to revamp the entire probate code, which is hundreds of statutes, to avoid this difficulty. I don't disagree at all with the caller that it is very frustrating, but it is a good reason to at least consult with someone ahead of time and see, because it doesn't have to be a trust. We don't have to have a complicated estate plan. Sometimes you can do things by non-probate transfers, adding beneficiaries to your properties, to your accounts, and avoid it that way. But probate avoidance is one of the top reasons people come in to see me, is they have been through the process and they do not want to have to go through it with their families.
This is what I don't get. If you have a will and you specify all of the things that we've been talking about in the will, why does the court have to get involved? You've made your decisions and your choices.
Well, under the statute, it provides that if you have a will, and that would be a document that is executed by you in front of two witnesses and a notary at the same time in the same room, which often fails. So it's very technical. But even if you have all of those hurdles, the probate code says that document must be filed with the court. and the court has the ultimate say-so over that. That's just how Missouri law is written, and that's how the law in most of the states are written, with a few exceptions. And so you're going to end up having your families in court if you have a basic will, and the court is going to ultimately protect not only your family, but the court is there also to protect your creditors and make sure they get paid.
All right, Stephanie, anything to add to that?
Well, that's why we need to speak to an attorney. You know, I mean, there are a few things, like this little one I told a minute ago. We didn't really need a big trust or anything. But most of us need to talk to an estate planning attorney to avoid probate, if possible. I mean, nobody wants – I've been through several probates. I don't want to do that again. Yeah. And I don't want to put my children or anybody else I know, because it's tough. And it eats up a lot of the cash.
Let's go back to the phones while we're talking about the will. Phil and Baldwin joins us. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, hello. Everybody in Radioland needs to pay attention to what I'm saying. I've taken paralegal courses, and I was being taught by an attorney. He taught the class, and he made the statement in class that he liked to put rich people in the will instead of trust. Trusts are the only vehicle that protects your family from the leeches of attorneys and the court system. And if these ladies need to explain that the only viable alternative is a trust. The only will that should be written is a pour-over will and a living will, which is really a medical directive. Any lawyer that suggests to their clients that they should get a will needs to be fired and needs to be brought up on charges, because a living trust is a trust, revocable or irrevocable, depends on your situation. They cost more money up front, but when you have a will, you not only have to hire an attorney and go to court, pay 8%, you also have to hire CPAs to watch over that the executor or executrix is not hiding funds or stealing things.
Phil, I think we've got the point. Thank you very much. I also think we've made the point that the trust is the way to go. But one of the issues that comes up, Melissa, again back to you, it concerns the cut, as I think one of the listeners put it, that lawyers get from the estate when it goes through this process.
Well, and that is only if it's going through probate. Mm-hmm. If you set up a trust, or if you set up some of these other strategies that are out there that can avoid probate, such as non-probate transfers, the attorney is not entitled to any kind of cut on those documents. Usually for my clients, if someone passes away, they may come in, they may meet with me maybe for an hour for me to explain the documents to make sure they understand what they're supposed to do. That's it. I don't get paid any percentage based on that. So the only time you're really looking into the attorneys and the system, so to speak, taking a percentage or a cut is when you're going to do a full probate. And I, you know, the probate law just provides that that's the case and how the attorney gets compensated. But that is a significant goal to avoiding probate.
And of course, the laws are written by lawyers. Forgive me for that. But that is basically the way the system works.
Absolutely.
Right?
I don't disagree.
Okay. Back to the phones. Paul in Kirkwood has a situation that I think we need to talk about. Go ahead, Paul.
Thank you very much, first of all, for the opportunity and for the very important program that you have and for the two ladies that are there and yourself. My family is currently going through a situation where I've lost both of my parents within the past 2 years. My dad recently is in March, and they were hardworking depression people, no truly formal education, GED, and things of that sort, and worked their heinies off their entire life to live a fairly comfortable life. I have a handicapped daughter and written and made a trust situations all the way back in 1985. They were never updated, and I was their caregiver for a long time and continually would ask them, you know, we have to make sure we get these things done. Well, turns out that taxes were not done, and that not only that, that there's no will to be found as of this time. And my comment is not only my purpose is just an aside for the horrible nature that can occur in a wonderful family. I'm the luckiest guy that ever lived in the world. Mm-hmm. But my parents would never do something like this. And my comment is that when a will is made, has there ever been a system or a recommendation that just as you take a real estate deed and you record it, is there anything such in the same manner that's ever been discussed for recording something like that, so that if there's a backup copy, the lawyer that happened to write up the information did exactly what the previous gentleman said. He had it set up for a poor of a will. There's a trust for a handicapped daughter that is taken care of, but it really wasn't administered to. And then there was a trust for my mom and my dad that were left open. They were never my dad. They never did anything to him, I guess, because they figured about the poor over state.
Paul, I think we have a lot to chew on right there. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're getting close to break time, and I want to get a response from Melissa to that.
Yes, there is a process whereby someone can record their will during their lifetime so that it would not be lost and could easily be located. Very simple process to file it with the probate court. If it is a pour-over will, which is simply a will that says to the degree there's a probate estate, it goes into the trust document. The trust document can also be recorded if there is a desire to do so. I generally, with most of my clients, they're trying to avoid being in the court system, and so we don't record the trusts, but I make it very clear to them as to where they should keep originals, how they should communicate those to family so that people can get their hands on the documents if they need them.
That is an important part of what you're saying in your book, too, is finding a place to keep those documents together.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know my attorney keeps on a disk. He keeps my trust on a disk, and it'll be there forever, you know, right, to even his successors, you know, as well as my own copies.
And if there is no will at all, I mean, this ensures probate, I assume, and that just complicates it that much because there is no directive of any sort.
Correct. And we call that intestacy in the legal profession, which means someone passing without a will or other documents. And unfortunately, what I think a lot of people are under the impression of is they assume that their assets would go to who they would think they would want them to, their children, if they have a surviving spouse. Missouri law, intestacy actually provides that if an individual passes away, married and with children, the children, even if they are minors, inherit one half. Their surviving spouse inherits the other half. The minor children, we have to set up a conservatorship. The court, until they turn 18, gets to say every penny that gets spent on. And then when they turn 18, they get checks, which is absolutely not what most people want.
And the court decides the conservator. It doesn't
necessarily.
It may or may not be a member of the family.
Correct.
Have to take another break. You've just heard from Melissa Riddle. She's an estate planning attorney. We're talking about end-of-life decisions. With us also, Stephanie Payne, the author of The Sandbox Wars, End-of-Life Decisions, the Most Important Gift to Your Family, and which she goes through the entire list of things that we ought to be doing and thinking about long before we reach those final days of our lives, not only for ourselves, but for our family members as well. Come back, take more of your calls in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about legacy decisions, end-of-life decisions, the need to plan prior to that time when we pass away and have to leave our property and what have you to friends, relatives, whomever. My guest in studio is Stephanie Payne, author of the book The Sandbox Wars, and estate planning attorney Melissa Riddle. We've been talking a lot about what goes on here in the state of Missouri, but half our audience, presumably, is in Illinois as well, and that's going to be different, Melissa. It's different states, different rules.
Correct. What you will find is that all 50 states will have legislation in that affects the estate plan such that if you are a Missouri resident and you execute a plan in Missouri that's valid under Missouri law, it will be honored by Illinois. Each state will have their different nuances, but if you are have something validly done where you are, it should last you even if you relocate.
The purpose of our conversation here, however, is to get the conversation started, get the planning started wherever you are, and whomever you talk with will tell you how it's going to apply perhaps someplace else.
Correct.
Back to the phones. Let's bring in Matt calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Matt.
Hi. Many, many years ago, I worked for a fee office for the Department of Revenue, and one of the ways that you could get out of probate for vehicles at least, was to assign a transfer on death in the title. I was wondering if that's still valid, number one, or if that would work with other large items, say the house, as long as the bank doesn't still own it.
Yes, that actually is a strategy that a lot of people do use. And including my estate planning clients, even when we set up a trust, oftentimes we may not put the house into the trust immediately because it becomes more cumbersome to buy and sell the real estate, to refinance. You also get certain creditor protections as husband and wife if you own it that way. And there's such a thing called a beneficiary deed in Missouri, which allows you to basically name a beneficiary for your home, which would transfer it on your passing. The same goes with TODs on vehicles, and we call them PODs on bank accounts payable on death. The only caution I would have in that is, while it can be an extremely effective way of avoiding probate, you do have to keep on top of those so that you don't disproportionately benefit some beneficiaries with an asset that has appreciated and unintentionally disinherit beneficiaries for assets that you may have transferred over into other accounts later on.
Thank you.
Matt, thank you so much for the call. We'll take Maria now, calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Maria.
Hi, this is Maria. I'm so thankful that you had me on your show. One of my comments, I guess, is this is such a fantastic topic, and one of the things that I just wanted to, I guess, mention is that you can frequently remember a charity in your estate plans, and that's one way to ensure that that you leave a legacy, you know, for future generations. And I just wanted to bring that topic up, I guess.
Well, thanks for doing so. Not a bad idea.
Yeah, and a lot of my clients do that, either with a set percentage gift or, if nothing else, as a residuary request, saying that if their children predeceased them or their children did not use their inheritance in their lifetime, the ultimate beneficiary would go to a charity. That's mm-hmm. very common and very noteworthy, and I'm glad that was brought up.
I did that with my trust. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stephanie, you had indicated in your book that there's a dark and a darker side to all of this. And part of the darker side is the fact that oftentimes this confusion within families and the competition within families leads to abuse of the person who is sickest.
When we're most vulnerable, when we're babies and when we're older, we are vulnerable to all kinds of abuse. And when I first met Melissa, we were talking, and I started likening how child abuse was like not talked about 30, 40 years ago, and now it's part of our conversation. And I want to bring this to the forefront, that how we treat our elderly, and especially with financial abuse, neglect, and all kinds of things that can happen to our elderly around the estate and the disposition of estates, is, I consider it an abuse. When my mom was getting ready to die, we had 5 attorneys, all of being paid out of the estate because my siblings didn't like what was happening. I thought, if that isn't a financial abuse, I don't know what was. And it was a horrible event, and it was completely unnecessary. And that's just one of thousands of those stories I've heard.
Well, and I think one of the things with today's society is, when I was growing up, my grandparents, both sets, lived 2 blocks away, and when they got older, we just checked in on them daily. They stayed in their homes. We took them in as they aged. And in today's society, our families are so spread out, and what this leads to is a lot of distrust, because you may have one family member or a caregiver here locally who is taking care of them, and the rest are spread out other places. They start seeing, well, now, you know, the local person has control of the finances. Is that really what the parent would want? And if the parent hadn't made that decision some time back, where everyone was comfortable, that was their wish, and they are perhaps developing some sort of dementia or memory capacity issues, is that really what their wish would be now? And oftentimes you will find a parent who maybe has some comprehension problems, who will want to be favoring the local child more because that's the child that they're dealing with and seeing on a regular basis. And that can just be a powder keg for the rest of the family.
Is there a point in which the person is no longer competent to make the trust or draw the will?
Yes,
there is. Who determines that?
I personally, as an attorney, don't ever venture into that. I will have their treating physician, if there's a question, do an evaluation on them. The capacity to make a will or a trust is not that high. It's actually quite less than making financial decisions. It's basically, do they have the ability to understand what they own and the natural bounty of what they own, who their children are, who would naturally receive that, and if they're making a change in the way that that would naturally be inherited, do they have the ability to comprehend that? It's not a high standard.
Stephanie, I would assume then that when this may be part of the picture, that this is when family can come in to it and challenge the documentation we're talking about.
It happens all the time. Yeah. I see it. I could just take story after story. They come in and I want to do this. I want the other kid says I want to do that, and they start a war because there were no documents. There's nothing in place, and you know, 3 or 4 years later, you know, after mom dies or dad dies, that you know they're still fighting.
Is there a time when you are too young to make a trust, for instance? I mean, life changes and your assets change. You do it at 21, and when you're 31, you're married and you have 3 kids that you didn't have when you were 21.
From my understanding, a trust can be changed, so it should be started as soon as possible, and then you add to it. Melissa has explained to me that you can add this paragraph and take out this paragraph and how many kids you have, and it's apparently a very easy, fluid document that can be changed and not at the huge expense.
A well-drafted trust is going to grow with you for the foreseeable future. We're going to try to add in the fact that you may have children or you may have additional children. But the nice thing about a trust is once you get it in place, it is very easy to make some tweaks to. Mm-hmm. It's literally, as Stephanie was saying, a one-page document that says, take this out and put this in instead. So it will grow with the family and may need to be revamped if there is some huge family event, but otherwise can usually be tailored as the family grows older.
We have some time left and we have some lines open, 382-8255. If you'd like to get into this conversation, that's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, or we'll take a tweet at STL on air. Stephanie, back to the book, and I do want to go over this checklist, by the way, before time runs out. A very touching element of the book is the need for reconciliation amongst family members and making amends, those final days when perhaps you've been estranged from someone in the family. It's a very touching aspect to all
Thank
of this.
Thank you. Yeah. That has been a real important part of my nursing career. I attempted it with my family, and it wasn't very successful, but I have scores and scores of families I've offered to call a relative, call a daughter or son that they hadn't heard from, and virtually 100% of the time, the reconciliation was one of the most breathtaking events. I get goosebumps just talking about it. I have seen children that hadn't talked to their parent for at least a decade or more, and all the forgiveness and joy that was missed was made up in a matter of days. And, you know, some clients, you know, expired fairly quickly. But what that does is just leaves a family a little bit more whole. And sometimes it can mend some of the injuries that caused the breakup of the family, whether it was abuse or, you know, some other thing that occurred. I've seen so many wonderful events about that. So I just encourage everybody out there, if you need to call a parent, please do. Most of the time, almost all the time, you'll get a terrific response that, oh, I missed you. Let's get together. And it's amazing the amount of healing that can occur.
We've talked a lot about documents and documentation for all of this. The checklist for legacy planning that you have in your book indicates what we should have. I'm just going to run down those quickly and get more information in the book or by calling Melissa or someone like her. Number one, a living will. Basically, as I mentioned these, comment on them very briefly, if you would. A living will, that's basically saying what you would like to have done under certain circumstances if you're...
Correct.
Pull the plug, I guess.
Exactly. And they go by different names, living wills, medical directives. That is always part of a package of documents that I would prepare as part of a full estate plan. And what you're doing is you're doing two things. You are setting forth the person to make those decisions if you can't do so that there's no question or gap in their care. And two, for the benefit of the person you're naming, letting them know what your wishes would be on life prolonging care if you were in a permanent vegetative state, no hope of recovery.
Medical power of attorney. I would think that would be the same thing.
It is. They're usually combined into one document.
Durable power of attorney.
That is for the financial aspects. Anything that is already owned by the trust would be handled by your trustee. There are certain items that don't go into trust, and that is simply a document to allow them to handle those financial items that are not in the trust.
The other items here, I think, are self-explanatory. Wills, we've talked about. Funeral arrangements, prearranging those, we've talked about. And personal property. What do you mean by personal property here?
Well, all the personal property, all the, you know, the things in our life. Make a list of them. So sometimes they're hidden. Sometimes they're in safety deposit boxes or whatever, but make a thorough list.
And who should get
them. And who should get it.
Let's go back to the phones. Ramsey joins us from St. Louis. This is a key point here. Go ahead, Ramsey.
Good morning, Don, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Your conversation said it keeps talking about family, married couples, et cetera. I'm a single person, never married. But by me being my professional career of being transferred all over the place, I mean different states, different everything, I've had everything in order since I was 21.
Good
congratulations. Good for you.
And I keep updating it because who would be closer to me than my family, and especially having siblings, you know, sisters, and everyone has a different taste. So everything I have is dedicated to one of those sisters. In the event of my death, one does my collection of this, that, and the other. But, you know, single people need to do this, too.
Absolutely.
You don't wait until, because anything could happen to any of us any day. And we can just look at the news and look, figure that out. So you don't have to be aged. But, yeah, encourage our parents, yes. But also encourage your young people, too.
Absolutely.
Ramsey, thank you for making that point. It's an important one. I think we have time for at least one more call. Angela in St. Louis, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I was just curious to know if there's such a thing as a joint living trust. My husband and I both have a five-month-old child, and I wanted to know what I would do if what we could do if we wanted to name who would take custody of our child in the event that both of us were to pass away at the same time.
Yes. In fact, most of my, especially younger couples, do like to use a joint revocable living trust because that's going to allow you to handle your assets the exact same way you do now as a married couple. You can set out guardianship provisions. Those are usually in the pour-over will. But those are, I would say, 90% of the trusts that I do, especially for younger couples, are joint so that each of the spouses can act alone and you can still manage things exactly the way that you do now without having the cumbersome nature of dividing things up between you.
Thanks for the call, Angela. I'm going to bring in Kathy, but it's got to be quick. Kathy, go ahead.
Hello. I have a twofold question. One is, what is the estimated cost of setting up a basic trust with an attorney? And two, do you suggest using any of the online programs to establish that basic document?
The online cost, or the cost is pretty broad. It depends on the specificity of what you need. I think you'll see the flat fees on those anywhere from $1,500 probably up to $15,000, depending on what you need, but they should be able to quote you once speaking to you what those fees would be. The online programs, the concern there is that each state is very state specific as to how the documents have to be executed and what types of witnesses and notaries are required, and it is easy to make a misstep and actually have the documents be invalidified as a result using some of the online programs, although I would probably say they're better than doing nothing.
We have a question here that is an important one concerning the joint trust. What if one spouse dies and the other survives?
Very good question. The couple can draft it one of two ways. They can make it so that it becomes irrevocable when the first spouse dies so that it is locked in stone and they're certain that they have the same beneficiaries. Or the couple can allow the surviving spouse to continue to make changes to it. It's specific to the couple.
All right. Very flexible. We're going to have to end it there. This has been a fascinating conversation. And one people are obviously very much interested in. Thank you, Stephanie, for bringing it to our attention that this is something we should be talking about. Stephanie Payne is the author of The Sandbox Wars, End of Life Decisions, The Most Important Gift to Your Family. If this conversation has been of interest to you, you might want to pick up that book and learn more. There's plenty more to learn. And estate planning attorney Melissa Riddle, thank you so much for being with us. Glad we had the legal expertise with us today because a lot of questions were along those lines. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the rights of the disabled and other disability issues with the new head of Paraquad, Amy Waymire, and with disability rights pioneer Colleen Starkloff. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.